We're doing a film about anarchism in America. Is there an anarchist influence in the anti-nuke movement?
No doubt about it. There's a lot. But it's manifested itself not so much in explicit opposition to the state as such, which is the most common form of anarchism, but in a way of operating that isn't centralist, where people who participate in these demonstrations and want to change their lives do so on a participatory basis rather than taking orders from central authorities. That's the way it tends to go. I mean, it's not that that's always successful, but there's that tendency towards decentralism, a tendency towards consensus operation, and at least from my perspective, a tendency to a strong nonviolent perspective, because I think the state is the ultimate violence. And so to see that nuclear power is violent, nuclear power is centralized, and we want to have a certain technology, we want to have another society where centralism of that sort, that authoritarianism, is dissolved and is more responsive to people's needs.
Although American individualism developed independently of European anarchism, both ideologies shared a profound contempt for government. Unlike the European anarchists, the individualists believed that people had the right to own private property, as long as it had been obtained by their own labor. Benjamin Tucker, editor of the prominent anarchist newspaper Liberty, denounced the capitalist monopoly of money, land, and tariff, and advocated peaceful change, not armed revolution.
Guided by these individualist principles, Josiah Warren founded two cooperative communities, Utopia in 1844 and Modern Times in 1851. Many of the 19th century individualists were also advocates of free love. Ezra and Angela Haywood of Massachusetts were outspoken critics of marriage and the subjugation of women. They were harassed and arrested numerous times for publishing and distributing writings on birth control and sexual freedom.
There's an instinctual anarchism in the American people, and it goes back to the Jeffersonian tradition. There's a real yearning for self-reliance amongst Vermonters, new and old. I mean, that's what they're up here for, living in these hills. So they appreciate, they're doing it. They may not call it anarchy, anarchism, but they're doing a lot of the things we talk about.
Like what kind of things?
Well, the first was being self-reliant, creating alternatives that meet your needs rather than accepting what the society as it is when you're born into it. In this little town, it's not a very big town, the people have organized a community center that shows films for adults and for children, that has potluck suppers, theatrical performances, meetings there. I see the latent anarchy, the beginnings of anarchy in New England town meetings, in volunteer fire departments, in food cooperatives, that people are responding to a desire to control their own lives, not be told what to do and how to think, and to be managed and bossed around, but to find ways in which they can take care of their needs, their material and emotional needs, within small groups on a small scale, where there can be direct democracy, and so where people do have a sense of really participating and really controlling their own destinies.
Decentralism and self-management are at the heart of the anarchist philosophy. Anarchists pose the question, why should the decisions which affect our lives be made in a remote, centralized seat of government? It doesn't make sense. People should administer their own lives, not relegate responsibility to somebody else.
The town meeting, the block association, the factory committee, these are all examples of anarchist types of organizations.
Well, I think there's an implicit anarchism in any of the American tendencies that have organized people in opposition to the state. And I think co-ops might have reflected this notion, organizing people not only in opposition to the state, in effect, but in opposition to the major economic movement of the time. I think, as a matter of fact, just in the romantic view of the American character, there's an anarchist tendency. It is flawed by one thing, the abstraction of patriotism. People who will damn the government from morning till night and oppose the state in a million and one ways will, at a times of national crisis, become incredibly patriotic and begin to say they will do anything for the state, and they begin to talk of duty, service, sacrifice, all of the words that are the worst words in the world, it seems to me, in a human sense. They begin talking about. Now, I don't know why this is, unless it is that these are such good-hearted people that they really believe that the American state is totally different from any other state, and it's certainly somewhat different, and that they feel that it is important to preserve. They feel they're preserving the country, but the only language that is available is to preserve the state. I have an idea that one of these days there will be another language in which we can talk about preserving the country, the landscape, the neighborhoods, the people, and the communities, without talking about preserving the state.
Beginning with the First World War, an alliance of the Departments of Justice, Labor, and Immigration initiated a campaign of repression. Agents broke into the homes of suspected radicals, arrested them, and seized their possessions. Many were deported. Most of the victims were foreigners, usually Russians, Italians, and Jews.
Two men stand out as targets of the anti-radical campaign. They were Italian-born, residents of Boston for many years, respectable workers and dedicated anarchists. They were attempting to dispose of some anarchist leaflets when they were arrested on a charge of armed robbery and murder. Their names were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti.
Oh, Sacco Vanzetti. Oh, Sacco Vanzetti. Sacco, Sacco Vanzetti. I just want to sing your name.
The state's evidence was flimsy, and the witnesses for the prosecution gave confused and contradictory testimony. Sacco and Vanzetti proclaimed their innocence, but they were convicted and sentenced to death. Appeal after appeal was denied. The case became an international cause. Marches and defense efforts were organized worldwide.
But on August 23, 1927, the state of Massachusetts, which had condemned Sacco and Vanzetti as violent and dangerous men, mobilized 500 heavily armed policemen to suppress protests and electrocuted the two Boston anarchists.
Believe that one can practice anarchism in this society. I believe it would be utterly illusory to contend, say, that a food co-op can replace general, you know what I mean, the Grand Union, or that a so-called People's Bank, to use a concept of Proudhon, who is supposed to have been an anarchist, could replace Chase Manhattan. Nor do I think that one can go around living a holier-than-thou ethical life, you know, that essentially amounts to an ongoing guilt trip against other people. I find that it is basically impossible to live a thoroughly anarchist life within a capitalist society. But I do believe this, that one can try to maintain a high ethical standard. And that is one of the beautiful things about anarchism, that it brings ethics into socialism instead of mere science into socialism, such as Marx does. That one can live an ethical life. One can concern oneself personally with what is humane and what I would prefer to call libertarian behavior. One can protest and one can try to work with projects in which people learn how to take control of their lives, even if in fact they can't do so until there are fundamental social changes. Those are the commitments, I believe, that anarchism seriously poses to the individual. And it raises a very high standard. It is demanding in that respect. It demands that you search into what is a humanistic sensibility and what is a humanistic ethic.
Audio excerpts of the film Anarchism in America, produced and directed by Stephen Fischler and Joel Sucher. We now move to edited audio excerpts of a companion film by Fischler and Sucher entitled Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists. Free Voice of Labor is the name of an anarchist paper. In the film, it often goes by its Yiddish name, Frei Arbeiter Stimme.
Anarchism in the 1880s and 1890s is probably the largest radical movement among the Jewish immigrants. These immigrants actually were upset by the world that confronted them when they arrived in the United States. They were disappointed. For some, of course, it's the legendary streets paved with gold, which they failed to find. I don't think any of the anarchist working men were anticipating anything like that. But they could not foresee the wrenching experience that they underwent from one world to the other. Oscar Handlin, the Harvard historian, wrote a famous book called The Uprooted. And they were uprooted from one land, one culture, one world, and cast into another world where conditions of labor were, if anything, worse than they had found, and more rigorous and more demanding than they had been in the old country. And the sweatshops were no better than the factories in Lodz or Bialystok, for example, from which many of them had come. And they were revolted by the entire ethic of capitalism that they found here in the United States, in New York, in Baltimore, in Boston, Philadelphia, and other large cities where they tended to settle, in addition to the Lower East Side. So what they did was to replace this world with a counterworld, American culture with a counterculture, and they began to establish their whole anarchist culture, an anarchist milieu.
On July the 4th, 1890, they started with the Freie Arbeiterstimme. The paper, from its very inception, was an economic paper, an anarchist paper, spreading the ideas of a society without government, without coercion, without force, without wars. The immediate task of forming unions to help to relieve the economic situation of this sweatshop worker, and at the same time helping develop Yiddish culture, Yiddish theater, Yiddish poetry, Yiddish literature. And it went on like this till the end of 1977. After 87 and a half years, the Freie Arbeiterstimme had to cease publication.
Anarchism is a philosophy which rejects all forms of government. It's the only radical movement, communism, socialism, although the communists and socialists ultimately also reject government, but it's the only radical movement which wants to get rid of the government right now. Freedom now is an anarchistic slogan, to abolish the state. The anarchists see the state and the church as the twin evils of oppression in modern society. In addition to opposing the state and wanting to abolish or do away with the state, all anarchists believe in a decentralized form of society. They saw the great trends of the 1920th century seem to be, at least superficially, towards more and more centralization, great hierarchies, where the individual was losing his sense of individuality and his power to the state, both economic and political. Well, the anarchists were individualists, they were federalists in advocating a loose-knit, decentralized society, they were anti-statists, they were anti-militarists, passionately against warfare, preaching love and brotherhood rather than hatred and war. I mean, life wasn't all dull for these anarchists. It wasn't all the sweatshop, although many hours of their day were spent working. They had their evenings. The amazing thing is they had enough energy in the evening to attend lectures. And for the one day that they were free from their jobs, they would go on an anarchist picnic, or they would go to an anarchist dance. They would hold raffles to raise money for the cause. The Arrestantenbäller, the Bäuerenbäller, these are the arrested balls, the peasant balls, which were held to raise funds for the prisoners under the Tsar. And they sent large sums of money. These working people who would have to save pennies to contribute to the movement and to subscribe to their newspapers would send substantial sums of money to Tsarist Russia through the Anarchist Red Cross. They founded an Anarchist Red Cross in the years before the First World War. So I say it was a whole world. In the 1960s and 1970s, we heard a great deal about the libertarian counterculture, which was counterposed to the American culture of statism, of militarism. Well, this had already evolved in the 1880s, 90s, and in the decades before the First World War.
I'd like to welcome all of you to the 7th annual reunion of the Friends of the Ferrer Modern School.
This is a reunion of the Ferrer School. The Ferrer School was an anarchist experimental school inspired by the work that Francisco Ferrer had been doing in Spain until he was martyred. And anarchists in America and in many countries organized such free schools where the children went to school and did not have to do anything that was set out by a teacher, but did the things they wanted to do.
The school was run by the kids, more or less, with the adults. It was a common, they had a common meeting, and we ran the school. You didn't have the kind of generation gap which we've seen in recent years, because there was nobody you were fighting against, in effect. The teachers were there, and they usually were called by their first name. And they were one of us all. You weren't forced to go to classes. You weren't forced to have marks or anything else. You could decide what you wanted to do. So that there was no, the authority came from not only yourself, but the whole student and school community.
The idea was that if children were removed from a regimented and demanding society which deformed them and put into a free ambiance, they would develop naturally and they would naturally learn as long as there was any opportunity to learn. Of course, living was learning, and learning was something that children naturally did.
In 1919, when the Communist Party started in the United States, it was a terrible blow to the Yiddish anarchists and to the readers of the Freie Arbeiterstimme. What happened is this. Just as in Soviet Russia, the communists used anarchist slogans. When, for instance, Lenin promulgated the slogan of the factory to the workers, the land to the peasants, all power to the Soviets, this is pure and simple anarchism. Remember, he never mentioned in all these three slogans, not the state, not the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, when the anarchists listened to these slogans, they were attracted to them. So here in the United States, just as way there as in Russia, anarchists worked with the Bolsheviks at the very beginning. But here, an interesting thing happened. Yanovsky, that clear-headed guy, said the Bolsheviks will never introduce these slogans, they will never practice what they preach. This is just a lie. It's not true. They're not going to give all the power to the Soviets. They're not going to give the factories to the workers. They're not going to give the land to the peasants. Everything will belong to the state. And he was against joining the Bolsheviks, against joining the communists here, and many of the young anarchists, most of the young anarchists, the most active, broke away from the Yiddish anarchists, broke away from the Freie Arbeiterstimme, and weakened it, and they formed the backbone of the Communist Party in the United States.
With the war, a tremendous hysteria seized the country. The atmosphere was terrible. Mobs and mobs of people chased the anarchists. The Attorney General was a man named Palmer. And the raids were made against all radical halls and homes of individuals. They would arrest people on no charges at all, let them out, then arrest them again.
Actually, the Palmer raids were the tail end of this. It all begins during the war itself, where the anarchists were, for the most part, what they called internationalists. They refused to take sides in the war. They were against war. They considered it to be a capitalist struggle where the workingman was used as cannon fodder for the purposes of imperialism and the spread of their own local interests, business interests. And the anarchists, of course, refused to fight. Many of them were pacifists by conviction. Others would not take up arms for any government. Not only did they refuse to fight, they agitated against conscription. When conscription was introduced in this country, America entered the war in April of 1917, Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman and many of the people associated with the Freie Abwehrstimme conducted rallies and made speeches trying to discourage people from registering for the draft, and eventually they were prosecuted. There were several laws that passed during the First World War. Espionage Act was one of them, for example, under which many anarchists and wobblies and militant socialists were tried and eventually convicted, sent to prison, and then ultimately deported. In one boatload alone on the Buford in December of 1919, the cargo contained 250 anarchists who were being shipped back to Russia, including Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman.
Henrik Ibsen, 1870, writing a letter to Georg Brandes, said, "Tie yourself to a star and sail with it. Every person must have a star, an ideal to which he clings. The ideal may not be realized today or tomorrow, but you must have an ideal which will carry you forward in life, will inspire you to do deeds and act. We are living in a society, we have made economic progress, we may have made here some slight progress, but ultimately, we are living a society with our slaves, poverty, misunderstanding, social injustice, all the wrongs of society. And they are people like foolish like myself and many others, call ourselves anarchists, who feel that this injustice can be done away with, that people can be educated. We must in our soul believe that justice must prevail. We must have that concept that we are going to carry on little by little. You see, the trouble is when you get people into a movement and they see the revolution over tomorrow, and it doesn't come tomorrow, they become disillusioned. They were never revolutionaries. They never had a concept, a true understanding. If the understanding, no matter what happens, you will carry on that ideal. You feel that justice must prevail. The concept of justice, moral certainty, that right is right. It is the doctrine that no matter what you call it, anarchist syndicalist, anarchist individualist, anarchist communist, whatever label you put to it, what is the ultimate goal of all these scattered ideas? Whether it's the idea of Proudhon, whether it's Kropotkin, whether it's Malatesta or anyone else. Each one had little variations, but the ultimate ideal, the ultimate concept of all of these people was ultimate human justice for everybody. And that is the ideal that anarchism stands for.
Audio excerpts of the film Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning.